Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the sudden about-face by Donald Trump, who cancelled the forthcoming summit in Singapore with Kim Jong-un in a letter to the North Korean dictator in which Trump makes childish boasts about Kim's puny nukes compared to his, writing, quote, "But ours are so massive and powerful that I pray to God they will never have to be used." Sumi Terry, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Affairs, who was previously the Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council, joins us. We will discuss how it appears Trump's new NSC advisor, John Bolton, first derailed the summit by referring to the Libyan model of nuclear disarmament, which alarmed Kim with the prospect of him ending up like Gaddafi. Then Vice President Pence went further by remarking that the Libyan model of the dictator ending up being torn apart by a mob could apply to Kim if he did not make a deal with Trump. This prompted the North Koreans to reply angrily, calling Pence a political dunce. And that caused Trump to write in his letter to Kim that, quote, "Sadly, based on the tremendous anger and open hostility displayed in your recent statement, the summit will not take place." Then we'll examine the meeting today arranged by the White House Chief of Staff in which Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, FBI Director Christopher Wray, and the DNI Dan Coats briefed Republican Congressman Devin Nunes and Trey Gowdy in response to the phony claims by President Trump, who is trying to manufacture a scandal he calls Spygate, alleging the FBI infiltrated his campaign and spied on him. Mark Lowenthal, the president of the Intelligence and Security Academy, who is Republican staff director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, joins us to discuss how wrong it was for Trump's new lawyer, Emmett Flood, to attend, and that allowing the Democrat Adam Schiff in at the last minute made it less of a partisan farce. Then finally, we will speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian John Meacham about his latest book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. We will discuss this urgent moment we are living in with America at the crossroads under a president who is at war with the truth and the law. But while it may seem we are facing unprecedented threats to American democracy itself, Meacham argues we have had presidents before who were not commensurate with the task and that we should not panic, but we also should not relax. And joining us now, Sumi Terry, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Previously was the National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sumi Terry.
Thank you for having me on.
And Sue, you must feel somewhat whipsawed trying to follow what's going on between the U.S. and North Korea. But it seems particularly disturbing that, as far as we know, the talks broke down, or the arrangements for a summit broke down, over John Bolton's statements about the Libya model being the one for the North Koreans to follow in terms of disarmament. They thought that meant ending up like Gaddafi. And then that was reinforced by Mike Pence, who suggested that if Kim were not to make a deal with Trump, he would end up with the Libyan model in terms of his fate. And that led the North Koreans to refer to the vice president as a political dummy. And that was apparently enough for Donald Trump to cancel the talks. Is that your understanding of the chain of events?
Yes. I mean, as President Trump was so spontaneous about his decision to accept a meeting with Kim Jong-un, which was done quite rashly. It was not really by anybody's advice, because we just, you know, it's a big deal for a sitting U.S. president to meet with a North Korean leader. And so this decision, I think it comes from President Trump, and he also spontaneously decided not to do it. When you look at the letter that President Trump has written to Kim Jong-un, it's very much his own words. I mean, you recognize his own words, like beautiful gesture and things like of that nature. So we'll see what happens and where to go from here. But, you know, it's, as you say, it's a whiplash. It's first, now there was going to be a summit, which was unprecedented, and now there isn't.
So what about reports, though, that Kim was nervous the fact that his plane doesn't have the range really to go anywhere further than Singapore, and he was even worried about getting to Singapore, worried about security there, even worried about being absent from Pyongyang, and in his absence there may be a coup. Is there anything to that?
I think he was skittish and nervous about his plane having enough fuel to make this round trip to Singapore. I mean, it's a genuine concern because no North Korean leader has flown that far. This is why Switzerland and Sweden, these countries, were ultimately ruled out as a potential venue because North Korea really does not have a plane that could take, you know, there's just no record. We don't even know a pilot has flown that far, a North Korean pilot. So it was a genuine concern. And I know the South Koreans were working, trying to alleviate that concern somehow, like allow him to stop somewhere where he can fuel or whatnot. But it's a real concern. Now, far as potential coup concerns, that's hard to say. The fact that Kim Jong-un accepted this meeting in the first place in Singapore with a publicly acknowledged date when he knew he was going to be away for a couple of days, that shows that he was pretty confident in his grip on power. So I think it had more to do with logistical concerns, like a plane, you know, that's able to make a round-trip flight to Singapore.
So what did you make, though, of President Trump's remarks the other day implying that he was annoyed with the Chinese, that Kim's tone and disposition towards these talks had changed after he made his second trip to Dalian in China, and President Trump was really implying that some of the Chinese are trying to screw up these talks?
Yes, I've been hearing that too, but it's hard to know because we don't really have a readout of exactly what occurred, what conversation took place between President Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un the second time they met. Chinese are, you know, they're in an interesting position. On one hand, you would think that China should welcome North Korea and U.S. sitting down together and easing tensions and no more talk of military strike and so on. And if there is a grand bargain of some sort, like a peace treaty or normalization, we might even reduce U.S. troops stationed in South Korea, which you would think the Chinese would welcome. But China is also very concerned that its own interest is not going to be protected. They don't like to be sidelined. And they are always worried about losing influence, both North Korea and South Korea, to the United States. So it's really hard to tell. It's hard to know exactly what Xi Jinping told Kim Jong-un. But sequence of events, because it's after he came back, Kim Jong-un came back from his meeting with Xi Jinping, you know, President Trump feels that something went wrong. So, I mean, I don't have hard evidence. It just is a sequence of events is suspicious.
Well, but in President Trump's photo opportunity today, where he spoke about pulling out of the talks in Singapore with him and Kim Jong-un on schedule for June the 12th, he went on at length about how powerful the U.S. military is. He talked about our military budget of $700 billion a year, how it's going to go up next year, and how he's rebuilt the military. We have the most fearsome military in the world. That struck me as not being the most appropriate way to deal with it, because one of the fears I've heard is that if these talks were to happen and go sour, then there wouldn't be much else to do except move towards a military option. And it seems like right out of the gate, he's talking about this, and does that concern you?
It does very much concern me. And even in the letter that President Trump wrote to Kim Jong-un, I don't like when he made a reference to, again, U.S.'s nuclear capability, how we have much more powerful capability. And again, in this statement that you just talked about, you know, how the $700 billion this year budget and, you know, $716 billion next year, and we have this amazing military and so on. It just feeds into Kim Jong-un's own paranoia. And already, when it is all this talk about Libya and what happened to Gaddafi, and they're concerned about security stuff, it's just this kind of rhetoric is not helpful. It's not productive. So I think we're just not really disciplined in terms of communicating the right message to North Koreans.
Well, in his letter, just that you, since you mentioned it, the Sumitary, Trump said, "You talk about your nuclear capabilities, but ours are so massive and powerful that I pray to God they will never have to be used." I mean, that's a little bit like kindergarten kids.
No, it's pretty juvenile. I wish that sentence was not in there. Otherwise, you know, you can tell that letter is very much written by Trump himself. Otherwise, you know, it's okay to sort of say, you know, I'm expressing sadness. I was really eager to meet with you. That's all fine. But yeah, that sentence that you just talked about, I think it's unfortunate.
So there was a piece at Reuters by Kent Harrington. I assume he was a former colleague of yours. He was station chief with the CIA in Northeast Asia. And he made the case that, and this was before Trump pulled out, but he made the case that he thought the entire focus on nuclear weapons was actually the wrong focus, that the real danger on the Korean Peninsula is the conventional weapons, particularly those on the part of the North, most of which the million-man army has all of these weapons trained on Seoul in hardened caves where within, you know, minutes the capital of South Korea could be absolutely ruined and this would absolutely devastate the country. Do you think he's got the right focus or that, in effect, what he's arguing is that so far we've had the wrong focus?
Well, it's not a wrong focus. It's just that I don't think it's necessarily wrong focus because what we are saying is nuclear capability to attack mainland United States. I mean, it's true. What he's talking about is that, of course, North Korea has conventional capability to wipe out South Korea and Japan. And they even have capability, nuclear capability right now in terms of South Korea and Japan threat. But if we're concerned about U.S. threat, I mean, this is where we're focusing on nuclear weapons. But I think it's overall relationship with North Korea. And it's not just a conventional versus nuclear, because they also have chemical and biological weapons, a very robust one, cyber warfare. I mean, and they, you know, so it's really about fundamentally altering our relationship with North Korea to deal with all these issues, not just nuclear versus conventional or conventional versus nuclear, you know?
Well, but what's this, your sense then of whether the South Koreans, we talked about you being whipsawed as a career special and me as a journalist being whipsawed by the White House, the South Koreans must feel really whipsawed.
Absolutely. President Moon Jae-in was just here. He thought he had a good meeting with Trump. He thought he was able to lay out a case of the summit, that he thought he was able to achieve his goal, which was to get, you know, that he left Washington thinking that Trump was going to meet with Kim Jong-un. And now, you know, I'm sure they're having an extremely panicked moment. I'm sure it's not a happy time in Seoul right now. And we didn't consult, Trump did not consult with President Moon before announcing this, you know, news. So I'm sure South Koreans are quite upset by it, and they will try to still work quite hard in the back channels, probably reaching out to the North Koreans and us, try to see if we can somehow, if they can get us to, you know, get back on the, get back to where we were in terms of having, you know, summit preparation and so on.
But Sumi Terry, is there a pattern here? Because the U.S. or Trump pulled out of the JCPOA, the P5+1 deal with Iran, and Pompeo said shortly thereafter that we can revisit the deal, Trump did too, and make a better deal. And they're more or less saying the same thing now, that we just pulled out of this summit, but we can turn around and make a better summit. That strikes me as being incredibly naive, because hasn't Kim Jong-un lost a lot of face on the world stage?
I don't know if Kim Jong-un has lost a lot of face. I think actually Kim Jong-un is in a better position today than where he was in November, December. As a result of Olympics, the diplomacy and summitry, even without summit with Trump, he has gained some respect by the world. He normalized himself. He did an image makeover. He got to meet with Moon Jae-in and Xi Jinping twice. Maybe he has weakened political will from China to continue to implement sanctions. He has completely weakened any kind of will for for military strikes. So it's not, Kim is still in a better position today than where he was a few months ago, I would say.
So do you think then that the North and the South could pick up the pieces? How far can they proceed without the U.S.?
Well, North and South can still continue to go on a little bit. I mean, there are family reunions. There are some good things that they can do on a humanitarian front. But you're right. I mean, ultimately, if the U.S. continues this fairly hardline policy towards North Korea and really try to ratchet up sanctions and maximum political pressure, South Korea will be caught in the middle, and it will be a very difficult position for Seoul to be in, trying to navigate between these, you know, Washington and Pyongyang. This is why I think President Moon is not going to give up so easily, and he's going to try very hard to see if he can get Trump and Kim to meet at some point in the future.
And you mentioned that the Chinese may be easing up on the sanctions, and it was, after all, my understanding is, was the fact that China joined the UN sanctions and really did implement them, and that did affect the North, and that many argue that that's what brought them to the negotiating table. Was there ever any evidence of triangulation on the part of Kim Jong-un? Was he trying to play the U.S. off against China? Would that explain what Trump was talking about in terms of blaming China for changing Kim's tone?
Well, yeah, we don't know what kind of assurance that Kim Jong-un got from Xi Jinping. If he said, you know, if we close the Punggye-ri nuclear site, if I don't test anymore, will you ease up on sanctions? And he got some assurance from Xi Jinping that he feels like now he can sort of come back and play a little bit more hardball with the United States. It's hard to know because there's still no readout of exactly what conversation took place. But it's true that after the first meeting between Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping, there was already, we've seen some relaxation of sanctions that China was implementing since the fall of last year. So that's something that we need to continue to monitor. And it would be also important to see how much the U.S. continues to pressure China to continue in terms of sanctions implementation.
But could Kim replace the economic lifeline he has with China as being its major trading partner and providing them with much-needed fuel and what little foreign exchange they get? Could there be a switch to the point where he could end up having closer relations with South Korea economically than with China?
Well, of course he can, but it's hard to do when United Nations Security Council resolutions are still in place. Unless that gets changed, you know, these member countries are obligated to continue on sanctions front. Now, that still doesn't mean that China will faithfully implement. There can be all kinds of UNSC resolutions. China could just choose to not implement them. It'll be a difficult case for South Korea to really open up economically, like let's say reopen the Kaesong Industrial Complex, because there will be in violation of United Nations Security Council resolution. It's not so easy to do, but again, political will in terms of implementing sanctions have been weakened.
Well, just at the end of the day, though, do you think the fact that these talks have been postponed and it doesn't seem likely that they will be resumed anytime soon? I was always puzzled as to why Kim agreed in the first place, particularly if at the end of the day it would mean him opening up his country more to the world. And that would, by definition, chip away at this sort of cocoon of delusion that the North Koreans have from cradle to grave. They're told that they are the center of the world and what a great deal they have. And if they were to learn that they don't have a very good deal, that the people in the South who are supposed to be starving actually have a robust economy and high standard of living, I never understood why he was willing to take that risk. Now it would seem he doesn't have to. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know what? The South Koreans kept saying, you know, Kim Jong-un is fundamentally different from his father, Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung, in that he's a very young leader. So he would have to rule next 30 to 40 years, and he doesn't want to rule a pariah, backward, poor state anymore, that he does care about how internationally he's perceived, that he does want to bring economic development to North Korea, and so on. But as you point out, if that is true, and it does show that there are some indications that Kim Jong-un wants to be a modern leader of modern North Korea. That's why when he came into power, one of the first things he did was build all these modern trappings of what he think would, you know, of a modern state, whether it's an amusement park or a ski resort or aquarium and so on. But even if that's true, as you point out, as he opens up, as he moves down this path, then it's going to be all kinds of issues. There's all kinds of hurdles that he would have to cross. Like, do you open the North up, for information to come into North Korea? Because that's what's required if you're going to truly open up your country for investment and everything else. And so far, North Korea has been living off, you know, the way the regime was able to continue was by having a monopoly on information and ideological indoctrination and making sure that outside information come into North Korea and so on. So that would always have been a challenge. So I think, you know, for now, maybe Kim got cold feet. We'll see. This summit is not going to happen, at least for the foreseeable future. And, you know, he will go back to, you know, doing what he was doing before.
Well, just in closing, though, I detect a certain amount of amateurism in this whole thing. And we know that President Trump is not your normal politician. He's not a politician at all. But I spoke recently about Bolton's remarks on the Libyan model, which the North Koreans reacted very strongly to, and said that they see him, I think the word they used was with repugnance. But I asked this specialist on the neoconservatives, wrote a book about the neoconservatives, about their influence over this administration. I said, is John Bolton off the reservation? And his response was, there is no reservation. So is it really that way at the White House that other people, because we have a vacuum at the top, people like Bolton and people like Vice President Pence can manipulate things to the point where the entire landscape changes and the president is a sort of passive observer in his own statecraft?
Well, I think it's kind of, you know, I mean, there's also people like Pompeo that Trump listens to. So, and I think he's been pretty reasonable, and he wanted engagement with North Korea. He's someone who went to North Korea, met with Kim Jong-un twice. So there is sort of, you know, multiple figures in his administration, and not everybody sees it exactly the same way. And, you know, it's not entirely for to blame the Trump, blame President Trump. I mean, North Korea did come up with these statements, even though it's a response to the Libya comment. But, you know, I always was wondering if North Korea was truly intentionally, you know, wanted to give up nuclear weapons program in the first place. So I don't think they've ever said that. They're intending to unilaterally disarm, basically. So it just basically what's happening is that these very different expectations we had very different definition of denuclearization. It's now coming to a head with a couple weeks ago, and that's why it got canceled, ultimately, because we couldn't bridge this gap.
Well, Sumi Terry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure.
And again, I've been speaking with Sumi Terry, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Previously was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the meeting today with Republican congressmen who, along with Donald Trump, are trying to manufacture a scandal Trump calls Spygate.
But the atoms here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite, and I seek out wherever evil resides. I spy. I'm at home in the streets of
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mark Lowenthal, president of the Intelligence and Security Academy, a professor at the Johns Hopkins University. He has served as an assistant director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, vice chairman for evaluation at the National Intelligence Council, deputy assistant secretary of state for intelligence, and staff director on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Dr. Lowenthal is the author of the Standard College Graduate School textbook on intelligence, Intelligence from Secrets to Policy, now in its 7th edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Lowenthal.
Thank you, Ian.
And what do you make of this briefing that took place today at the DOJ, which was apparently set up by the Chief of Staff of the White House, John Kelly? But he brought along Donald Trump's new lawyer, Emmett Flood. The White House is saying that they didn't stay for the whole meeting. And it looks as if there was a sort of – originally it was only going to be Devin Nunes and Trey Gowdy. And now they've sort of brought in the gang of eight. But then apparently Nancy Pelosi decided not to show up and delegated Adam Schiff, the minority chair of the House Intelligence Committee, in her place. So it looks as if at least at the last minute there was a little bit of fairness in this. It was originally just going to be no Democrats.
Right. If there were no Democrats, then this would be a very unprecedented and highly suspicious briefing. And there are precedents in the past. When I was the staff director of the House Intelligence Committee, sometimes I or my staff or the members on my side would get briefed separately from the Democratic staff or the Democratic members. So that's okay. But if you're only going to brief one side, which is where they were until some point last night, I think, that would have been very unusual. Having Emmert Flood there, even for part of the briefing, is extremely unusual. This was a briefing for the Oversight Committee, and why the White House attorney, why Trump's attorney was there. I mean, I know why he was there, but that's not really within the bounds of how you typically do these things.
Well, isn't it a case of the investigate Ed putting investigators onto the investigators?
Yeah, well, I think what's going on here is that the Trump people, and that includes Devin Nunes, unfortunately, are trying to undercut the legitimacy of the Mueller investigation by saying, look, the intelligence community was spying on my campaign. They weren't spying on his campaign. There were serious and legitimate counterintelligence concerns about the activities of certain people who were on the campaign, Lewandowski and Manafort, and their contacts with the Russians raised counterintelligence concerns. And so they were being investigated, not because they were working for Donald Trump. They were being investigated because their contacts with the Russians were problematic. But Trump is spinning this as, you see, they were spying on me. This is all a setup. And and for the average American, that's going to be very hard to parse.
Well, that's why I guess he's using the term Spygate, and that's being,
yes,
you know, echoed through the kind of echo chamber of Breitbart and Fox News. And so do you think at the end of the day that will be successful in what? In either thwarting, stopping, or stalling the Mueller investigation? That seems to be the intention.
No, nothing's going to stop. I don't think anything will stop the Mueller investigation. I don't think it will thwart it. I think what they're trying to do is delegitimize whatever it is that Robert Mueller finds before he finds it, or before he issues his report, whenever that is. They're trying to create sort of a fire break and say, look, none of this is legitimate. This is based on illegal spying on my campaign, and this was just a witch hunt. We're back to that again. He knows he can't stop Mueller. He's tried. Mueller's not going to stop. Mueller's not going to agree to a timeline. Mueller has shown tremendous independence and integrity. But if he can raise doubts about why this thing started, then some people may not give Mueller's report the attention that Trump would like to avoid.
Well, so far, Devin Nunes has managed to throw some sand in the gears. He's made a big fuss out of the FISA warrants that were used to surveil Carter Page and George Papadopoulos. But in Carter Page's case, I can't see how you can make a case out of the fact that there were at least five, I think, FISA warrants that were extended, because he was literally being recruited by Russian spies who the FBI caught. And you can read the transcripts. I mean, they're talking about this guy like, who is this greedy idiot that we're trying to recruit, you know? I mean, what more? Go ahead.
I always tell my students, when, you know, if you're thinking about spying for the Russians, besides the fact that it's stupid, they don't pay well. but Nunes has just, I mean, I was the first Republican staff director of the House Intelligence Committee, and I really believe in the concept of congressional oversight. That's how my career began in 1975-76. And I really think Devin Nunes has trashed the entire concept. He's trashed the integrity of his committee, because he's decided my job is to defend the President of the United States, regardless of what I do institutionally, to the House Intelligence Committee. Now, the House Committee has always been a partisan committee in terms of structure, whereas the Senate Committee is a bipartisan committee. But in the previous Congresses, Mike Rogers was the Republican chairman from Michigan. and Dutch Ruppersberger was the ranking Democrat from Baltimore, and they worked very, very well together. They decided, you know, now is a different time. We didn't have quite the same issues, but they just decided, you know, we're not going to allow partisanship to get in the way of a lot of this. We're going to try and rise above that. And they really set a gold standard for how to do intelligence oversight on a committee that's a partisan committee. Nunes, on the other hand, decided, I'm going to do what I can to defend the president, regardless of my institutional role here in the House Intelligence Committee. And he's been backed up by the Speaker, by Mr. Ryan.
So the other person, of course, that came up in this, and this is what they were wanting to look at today, what Trey Gowdy, who, of course, is famous for the Benghazi hearings, and Devin Nunes, is that there was an FBI informant that had been used extensively by both the CIA and the FBI. He's based in the UK. Mm-hmm. He apparently was at a seminar on intelligence at which Trump's first national security advisor was there,
Mike Flynn,
and he was very alarmed by Mike Flynn consorting with a young Russian woman who appeared to be some kind of FSB honey trap. He reported on that. He had met with both Carter Page and George Papadopoulos and reported into the FBI because the FBI asked him because of his fact that he was a well-known Republican figure who had worked for both Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George Bush. So he's the perfect guy for the FBI to approach these guys who are Republicans. They're not going to listen to some Democrat.
Right.
You know? I mean, and this is what they're looking into. This is what the secret stuff that they're supposedly looking at today.
Well, they're trying to make a case that the FBI was spying on the campaign. The FBI was trying to find out what was the relationship between these two individuals, stress individuals, and the Russians. And to my mind, that's a very different question. But I also understand the tactic involved of the Trump administration.
Well, but that then leads us to speculate, Mark Lowenthal, whether we live in post-truth America. So if you... for example, today, after this meeting, Representative Adam Schiff, the minority chair of the House Intelligence Committee, who was sort of deputizing there for at this meeting for Nancy Pelosi at the Gang of Eight meeting, he came up to the cameras and said, nothing we've heard today has changed our view that there is no evidence to support any allegation that the FBI or any intelligence agency placed a spy in the Trump campaign. So that was his...
Right.
Do you think that's going to resonate?
At this point, very few people are objective about this. If you're a Trump supporter, you're going to believe Devin Nunes. And if you can't stand Donald Trump, you're going to believe Adam Schiff. I mean, on issues of intelligence, I try to maintain my objectivity as a one-time intelligence officer. But I think that Schiff's perception of it is probably the correct one. But that's not going to matter. You know, Mike Hayden, who is the former director of NSA and CIA, is a book that just came out saying, you know, this is intelligence in a post-truth world. You know, remember what Kelly Conway famously said, the president has alternative facts. Now, there's no such thing as alternative facts, but that's how they operate. And that's how he's trying to manipulate this debate. Like I said, I don't find anything disturbing in what the FBI did. It's a counterintelligence investigation, but it happens to be two people who happen to be involved in the Trump campaign. But it's because of their Russian connection, not their Trump connection. But Trump is going to play that second part down. And that's just where we are.
Well, then you have to accept, I think, that the country's already been infiltrated by Vladimir Putin, because he's the one that showed the way to create a post-truth society.
Well, yes.
You know, his political technologist, Surkoff, came up with this idea where everything is true and nothing is real. And that is what they've done in Russia.
But this is a Russian tradition that far predates Vladimir Putin and Joseph Stalin and goes back to Catherine the Great in the 1790s and the creation of Potemkin villages or false fronts. This is a long-time Russian technique. They've just found better ways to do it. Using the internet, creating, you know, unfortunately, places like Facebook and all these other social media sites, none of which I am involved in, give you the ability. There's a great cartoon in The New Yorker some years ago. It shows two dogs sitting at a computer, and the dog on the who's typing says to the other dog, on the Internet, nobody knows you're a dog. Well, that's sort of where we are. They found ways to manipulate it, and Facebook especially, but some of the other social media sites, facilitated this. Because Facebook's only interest was eyes on page and dollars. And now Zuckerberg is going around apologizing, saying he's sorry, and he was an accomplice to this. So the fact that the Russians are doing this is not new. The fact that they were this successful is somewhat new. But this didn't begin with Vladimir Putin. The only thing you have to know about Vladimir Putin is this. He famously said, there is no such thing as a former KGB officer.
Well, he is, but the point I'm making is that this has been his successful export.
Yes, he's been very successful. He's probably tickled at how successful he's been. He was probably stunned that this worked and that Donald Trump became the president, but everybody was stunned, including Donald Trump. Although he's beginning to discover that it's somewhat disappointing. He's not exactly getting what he wanted out of Donald Trump.
Right.
The message has been confused. I mean, and Putin despised Hillary Clinton.
And Barack Obama.
I mean, when you see pictures of the two of them together, if you look at body language, boy, do these guys not like each other.
So, Mark Lawrence, go ahead. Sorry.
No, you go ahead. That's fine.
Well, I was going to say, though, as a former intelligence officer, how do you see our way forward if we are in post-truth America, if there's no consensus about what is true and what is real?
I think the obligation of intelligence officers is to call it the way they see it. I will tell you that I was just teaching a class at an intelligence agency this afternoon. I don't like the phrase that our role is to tell truth to power, because I think it's arrogant. But I think our job as intelligence officers is to put out there, this is what we think happened, and to keep saying that, even if not everyone will believe you, even if some people will attack your integrity. I think our professional responsibility is to say what we think happened.
Right, but the
Right. Well, you know, there's always people you're never going to convince. I mean, I've dealt with policymakers who have yelled at me because they didn't like what I was saying to them. I've had policymakers tell me that I had no understanding of what they were doing, and you just stand your ground. I had a senior official want me fired because I stood up to him in a briefing. And when I went back to the CIA and reported in on the seventh floor, the reaction was, hey, he wants 40 other people fired. Get in line. And I wasn't fired. I think our job in this situation is what Mike Hayden is doing and what Michael Morell is doing now, and Jim Clapper. Now, there's an interesting question to be raised, that by taking as active a defense as these gentlemen do, and these are all friends and colleagues of mine, are they not making Donald Trump's case for them that the intelligence community is politicized? And I think that's something that intelligence professionals have to consider. I mean, I've known all of these men for 25 years, and I know they're not political types. They're trying to defend the integrity of our profession. But unfortunately, it does give Donald Trump ammunition. But your choice is to withdraw from the field and let him have free reign over it, or continue to say what you think is happening and accept the fact that he's going to twist it.
Well, just think,
we've never seen U.S. intelligence in this situation before. This is unprecedented.
Well, just in closing, though, in the lobby of the CIA, there's the inscription from the Gospel of St. John.
Yes, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free.
Right, so the second part of that, the truth shall set you free, I'm not sure that that's happening anymore.
I'm not sure that it is either, Ian, on that really pessimistic note.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you for joining us, Mark Lawrence.
My pleasure, Ian. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Lowenthal, president of the Intelligence Security Academy, a professor at Johns Hopkins University, served as assistant director for Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, vice chairman for evaluation at the National Intelligence Council, deputy assistant secretary of state for intelligence, and staff director on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Dr. Lowenthal is the author of the Standard College Graduate School textbook on intelligence, Intelligence from Secret to Policy, From Secrets to Policy, now in its 7th edition. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian John Meacham about his latest book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is John Meacham, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author whose books include the New York Times bestsellers Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, American Lion, Andrew Jackson and the White House, Franklin and Winston and the Destiny, and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. He's a distinguished visiting professor at Vanderbilt University, a contributing writer to the New York Times Book Review, and a fellow at the Society of American Historians. And his latest book just out is The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Meacham.
Thanks so much.
And it appears at the moment that President Trump is both at war with the truth and at war with the law. And his moves of late to basically contain the Mueller inquiry by ginning up this phony idea of a spy and infiltration of his campaign. And you can see that the drumbeat of that is going to get louder and louder. And then today, a couple of prominent Republican congressmen, Devin Nunes and Trey Gowdy of the Benghazi Committee, are literally looking into what Mueller is doing. They have unprecedented access to his work product, which is highly classified. And I expect that at some point or other that may well end up being leaked and perhaps manipulated, and it'll appear later on Fox News, if not be used in a potential defense for the president, who now knows what they might well have on him. So I guess this is a long-winded way to say that it seems like we are at a critical moment in this country where our democracy is under threat and that we could end up like Russia. So please tell me I'm not being too pessimistic here.
I think you're being a little too pessimistic. I think you're right to be concerned. I think you're right that it's a perilous moment in the life of the Republic. It is in its own way as serious, if not more so, than say the crises that shook us at the end of Vietnam into Watergate 40 years ago. And it is there's a crisis of faith in the system that has been a slow-moving but inexorable unfolding crisis since World War II in many ways, certainly since the Vietnam War. So you're right to be vigilant, to be concerned, to speak out. But my argument ultimately is that the system is resilient, the Constitution is resilient, and our country has been defined more often by strife than by smooth seas, if you will. And so I have every expectation that as long as the people are vigilant, as long as the press, broadly put, tries to report what's going on, as long as the courts do their job, as long as Congress at some point becomes a force for good, then we're going to be all right. But it's not guaranteed, and it requires an enormous amount of civic effort, which is essential but is dispiriting and exhausting, which is something I think the president is counting on, that by creating so much drama, he wears us all out. That's what we have to guard against.
But in terms of what appears to be almost an extinct species now, the moderate Republican, and you are very close to the former president, George H.W. Bush, and you delivered a eulogy at the recent funeral for the former First Lady, Barbara Bush. He's sort of an exemplary, I think, example of the moderate Republican that used to be. And when you contrast mm-hmm. that to what's happening today on the Hill with Devin Nunes and Trey Gowdy, and they've deliberately excluded the Democrats. But at the last minute, they let in the Democrat Adam Schiff, but they also allowed Trump's new lawyer, Emmett Flood, to show up. So it leaves me to be sort of, on the one hand, feeling like the Democrats are kind of gutless and useless, and on the other hand, that today's Republicans are just sort of rabid. They're almost like junkyard dogs.
We're in a moment that is Hobbesian, right? I mean, it is the war of all against all. And I think to some extent this can be traced back to the Gingrich Revolution against George H.W. Bush in 1990-91, when President Bush raised some taxes in order to get a budget deal to introduce some fiscal discipline at a time when the deficits were seen as a threat to our broader global power. Gingrich opposed it. He led a revolution that ultimately produced a House majority for the first time in 40 years. And I think what a lot of Republicans, particularly on the House side, learned from that is warfare pays. And conflict is the best route to power. What someone like President Bush understood, what his son understood, it was that ultimately what matters most is what you do with that power. And that is a vanishingly rare understanding and vision of politics at the moment. But that ebbs and flows. There's nothing guaranteed about the success of the American experiment. And it's about not just the people who are in power, the people who are in office, but it's about all of us. And the fact that voter registration numbers among young people are rising, the fact that so many people are motivated by what they see as overreaching by the president, I think is a source of some hope. It's not a guarantee that everything's going to work out, but it does show that the opposition is vigorous, it's strong, and it's about 55% of the country. 45% or so of the country approves of what the president's doing. 55 or so does not. And the constitutional system protects the rights of the minority, but it also ultimately enables the majority will to prevail. And I think that's what we'll see. I certainly hope so.
Well, I'm sure that the Founding Fathers did not anticipate a kind of American Pravda, in effect. They didn't anticipate Rupert Murdoch and the idea that you could create an alternative reality which between 30 and 40% of Americans would be in.
With respect, they did anticipate that. If you read the constitutional debates, if you climb inside the deliberations of the framers, they fully expected, because they didn't know what a neutral press was. Everybody was a Rupert Murdoch in the 18th century. Every right. newspaper, every publication was partisan and devoted to a particular interest. They did anticipate demagogues. They did anticipate that the populace would run, would be affected and buffeted by passion. It's one of the reasons for the complicated checks and balances, is they wanted to have enough symmetry, if you will, that it would at least prevent a particular faction from taking control for an overlong period of time. That's the entire structure of the Constitution. So I think they did anticipate this. I think they would have been surprised it took so long for it to become quite as bad as it has.
Well, that's, I guess, I was going to get to the point of how can the lone superpower function if there's no consensus about what is true and what is real. And, of course, back in the days of Uncle Walter Cronkite, there was some kind of consensus. I was very struck by the former Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who left this administration and presumably has some insight into it. At the commencement for VMI just a week or so ago, he said, an essential tenet of a free society, a free people, is access to the truth, a government structure and a societal understanding that freedom to seek the truth is very essential to freedom itself. If our leaders seek to conceal the truth, or we as people become accepting of alternative realities that are no longer grounded in facts, then we as American citizens are on a pathway to relinquishing our freedom. This is the life of non-democratic societies comprised of people who are not free to seek the truth. So if indeed, and I know that the early days, the yellow journalism was in fact journalism, but is there a relationship between my job as a journalist and my concerns about the truth being a moving target expressed by the former Secretary of State?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a perennial concern that people will respect facts. People will accept that there is a clinically accurate set of circumstances about which we can then form opinions. The problem you're putting your finger on, and that Secretary Tillerson talked about, is there is too few of us assent to a fact if it's inconvenient. So we take an entire worldview, and you know, as somebody joked, I wish I'd thought of the line. They hope that Hillary Clinton watches Fox News because it's the only place in America where she's president. So it does offer this alternative version of reality. And that was a concern, say, of Thomas Jefferson. He was always worried that that the country would return to a view of, in his world, hereditary authority, religious superstition. You know, the American Revolution is, at its core, the world's largest gamble in many ways on the capacity of reason to take a stand against passion in the arena. The revolution was a political manifestation of the European Enlightenment, the Scottish Moral Enlightenment, the Scientific Revolution, the Protestant Reformations, the translation of sacred scripture into the vernacular, an entire reorientation of the world from being seen as vertical, where popes and princes and prelates and kings told us what to believe, to a more horizontal understanding, where we could all be born with the capacity to determine our destiny. And that was based on reason as opposed to a blind acceptance of tradition or any singular worldview. And what I would urge American conservatives to do is, if you want to talk about original intent, that's the genuine original intent. Even before the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence is an assertion that reason, that the work of the mind and the disposition of the heart is just as important, if not more so, than a political gamble of a particular moment. And we have to be true to that.
So how do you steer the country away from this societal trend, both in terms of reality shopping, where people choose their own truth, and the earlier part of our conversation about the lack of civility and the polarization and the demonization in our politics? To some extent, I think it's also happens in our business schools. You know, they use phrases like take no prisoners and, you know, slash and burn. I wonder where that impulse comes from, that kind of militaristic impulse to win at all cost.
Well, it's a fundamental human impulse. It's what Hobbes was writing about, that the social contract was about moving away from a state of nature. And right now we're more often in a state of nature, you know, nasty, brutish, and short. It's just now it's nasty, brutish, and long. So this is one of the most fundamental conflicts, one of the most fundamental struggles any society faces. And it's particularly acute at the moment for a variety of reasons, chiefly that a broad swath of the American public, largely white, largely working class, believes that the ladders of prosperity to a secure middle-class existence no longer exist for them. And they blame upward, and they blame around. They blame the elites, they blame globalists, they blame bankers, they blame people who are winning in this system. And they're also blaming people of color and immigrants and minorities who are on their way to being, you know, plurality. We're not going to be a majority white country very long. And so this is an era where the politics of fear, the politics of pointing at people as opposed to pointing ahead, is prevalent. And my own sense is that the best way out of this is a historically based argument that convinces people, or at least attempts to convince people, that the best way to guarantee fair play for you is to guarantee fair play for the other guy. And that's what has made the country worth the struggle, worth the fight, worth the preservation. And the more we can remind people that we have always become stronger the wider we've opened our arms, then I think the better chance we have of getting them to listen to those better angels.
And in terms of no consensus on what's true and what's real, obviously that's also being exacerbated by new technology in terms of social media. Facebook, I think two-thirds, three-quarters of Americans get their news from Facebook. And we know, of course, that was skillfully used by the Trump campaign. They caught Hillary Clinton flat-footed on that one. If that's a trend, both societally and driven by new technology, how do you reverse that trend, do you think?
I think you have to fight on that ground. I think that I don't think there's really reversing it as much as now using it. And being on those platforms, being in that arena, vigilantly fact-checking, vigilantly pushing back against truly fake news. It's not a bad phrase. It's just applied to the wrong stuff. And that's the struggle. And, you know, you can't subcontract that battle. You can't outsource it. It requires everybody and genuinely everybody. And I'm not trying to sound like the 4th of July or a graduation speech here, but we are at a moment because all of us have access to the same platforms, and anything any of us say can go around the world within seconds. We all have the means to, if you see something that seems fake, if you see something that seems wrong, say so. You know, push back right there in the best American tradition of being disputatious, and at least take a stand and say that if you're willing to believe something outlandish about an opponent, you know, if it seems outlandish, it probably is. And so I think that's the only genuine answer outside of a kind of censorship that I think is a slippery slope. You know, who should have the power to censor? You know, even if it, sometimes it deserves it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, John Meacham.
Thanks so much.
And I've been speaking with John Meacham, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, whose books include the New York Times bestsellers Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House, Franklin and Winston and the Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. He's a distinguished visiting professor at Vanderbilt University, a contributing writer to the New York Times Book Review, and a fellow at the Society of American Historians. And his latest book just out is The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Moss. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Kathleen Ash and Alejandra Lariva Latt. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.